This is Seattle's Morning News. Dave Ross with Miley Katie and Harmon Shea this morning. And joining us is CBS Senior Business Analyst Jill Schlesinger. So the cards are on the table. We know that the president wants to pay for all these new programs by raising the corporate tax rate and taxing the rich. Jill, is it even possible to tax the rich? The rich have ways of not being taxed, don't they, that transcend whoever happens to be president?
Well, you know, it's tough when you're if it's a rate, no. So there's a couple of things. I think these proposals are kind of interesting. The least interesting is the one that gets the most headlines, which is raise the top rate from 37% back up to 39.6%, which is where it was before we had the 2017 tax cuts. So 39.6%. So that, you know, essentially, just think in your head, it's about people who earn more than couples who earn more than about $500,000 and individuals who earn more than $450,000. Any income above those levels, you get taxed a little bit more. Okay, fine. But the real interesting part of this plan, and this is, again, under the proposed American Families Plan, is two different aspects. Number one, changing how long-term capital gains are taxed for people who make more than $1 million. Mm-hmm. This is a biggie, and I'll tell you why. Right now, let's just say, Dave, you make $1.5 million a year. Mm-hmm. I know. It is fantasy land, but let's just say. let's say you make more than $1 million a year. If you sell a stock or a mutual fund that you own outside of retirement, what happens? You are taxed at the top long-term capital gains rate of 20%. Mm-hmm. And there's actually an extra 3.8%. So what you need to know is if you know, Dave sells his mutual funds, he's held them for many years, he sells them right now, and he pays a total rate of 23.8% on the assets he sells. Mm-hmm. Okay, now, under this plan, the rate goes from 23.8%, it goes actually up to 43.4%. How do you like that, Mr. Ritchie?
That's a real tax. But here's the thing. I'm still making over $1 million a year.
Okay, so yes, of course. Of course, of course. But, you know, when it doesn't matter, I've learned this, that, you know, when I talk to people, it doesn't really matter that that is the case because most people are going to feel like you're taking something away from me.
Well, you are.
You are. Exactly. And I think what's kind of interesting about this is, you know, so basically it's saying if you make more than $1 million a year, you don't get a special rate on capital gains because we know you're just really rich and you are going to keep buying and selling stuff and paying. You're going to pay whatever your ordinary income tax rate is. So that's why we get to that high number. We talked about 39.6. It's going to be 39.6. There are a lot of people who actually think that capital gains rates shouldn't even exist, that we should just have just one tax rate. It's ordinary income. But this is just for rich people. But here is the much more, I think, under the radar, stealthy and more impactful change that the Biden administration has put in this plan. They want to change the way that we tax money that's inherited after death. So right now, let's just play pretend right now. Okay. So Jill dies and I have a portfolio of mutual funds and stocks that I've owned for a long time. And right now it's worth $2 million. Mm-hmm. Maybe I paid like $100,000 for it, but it's worth $2 million. Right. If I drop dead today and all my money I leave to Dave Ross, you then inherit that money as if you bought it for the date of death valuation. Basically, yes. It's the step up. It's a step up. Instead of you saying, oh no, I have to pay, I paid $100,000. My dear friend Jill left me assets. She bought it $100,000. And so you would think you just inherit that cost basis and you sell it later. No, in the law as it stands, you get what's called a step up in cost basis. Okay. The theory being that you've already paid taxes on it once, but it's baloney. It's total baloney because, of course, if you sold it during your life, you'd have to pay tax again. So I don't know why in your death it should be treated differently. So under this plan, there's no more step up in cost.
Oh, my gosh. That is huge.
That's big, right?
Yes.
That's a biggie. Now, there's a little carve out. And it's very similar to the way we treat the sale of primary residences. Under the Biden plan, you would see the elimination of a step up in cost basis at death. But there would be a provision that would exclude $1 million of gains from taxation. So let's just say, in my example, you inherit that $2 million. Mm-hmm. There's a $1.9 million gain. You get to say of that 1.9, $1 million is excluded. You got to pay tax on 900,000. Good luck to you. I hope you do well with my money.
Hmm. But still, you get $1 million. Here's the thing I found out about the income tax. There have been rich, there have been years when I've been rich, and there have been years when I've been not so rich and paid less tax. But even in the years where I paid the maximum tax, I was still net better off than in the years where when I paid less tax, because that's just how the income tax works.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, this is the funniest thing, that, you know, you can really play games with yourself. Of course, this reminds me of the great Susan Schlesinger, also known as my mother, who likes to say, rich or poor, it's nice to have money. Yes, of course, you'd like to keep more of your money. Who wouldn't? But yes, there is there are very few examples where you say, oh, I'm in worse shape because I made more money. Where does that happen, you know? And so I think that what is interesting, I think if you really wanted to kind of blow open the holes in the tax code, one is that I don't think that we really have a problem with raising capital and deploying capital. The world is awash in cash. So frankly, the entire capital gains rate system could be like just wiped off. We could be done with that. And in fact, when you think about all those deductions that exist, they really favor rich people. And you know what we found? When rich people get lots of tax deductions, they don't go out and create more jobs. They just get richer. That's the lesson of the last 30 years.
Okay, but one possible caution here. What about people who want to pass a small business, all right, which may be worth multiple millions of dollars beyond that that inheritance threshold? What about when they want to pass that business on to their kids?
Yeah, that's going to be a tough one. There's going to need to be some planning. I mean, the business will have to be evaluated. This is what's hard. When you have a large but illiquid asset, it becomes a much thornier problem. Yeah. And this happens with real estate and it happens with small businesses. But, you know, the IRS has dealt with this for years when it comes to especially a closely held business and how to tax it upon death. You know, and frankly, as a small business owner once in my life, what I can tell you is that we had a plan for that. And the way we did it is we carried big insurance policies on the partners of the firm. And if one partner died, the money flows out and it pays taxes and allows us to buy the assets from the other person's estate. That's how mm-hmm. you do it. It's called funding a buy-sell agreement with life insurance, and it's actually very doable. But the idea that you don't ever have to pay tax on a gain is a silly idea, because during your life, you would have to. And so why at your death are these assets treated differently?
Right. CBS Senior Business Analyst Jill Schlesinger. Jill, thank you very much.
Great to be with you.
This is Seattle's Morning News. Our pandemic preoccupation has eclipsed pretty much any other medical news, so let's fix that, because there are other diseases out there, like cancer, and about 40% of Americans are going to get a cancer diagnosis at some point in their lives. But there are a lot of myths about cancer, and since May just happens to be National Cancer Research Month, this would be a good time to call in the doctor.
Agent Dr. Cohen.
Dr. Gordon Cohen, MD. So start us off with, what are the current stats on cancer and how fatal it is?
It's the C word, and everybody's afraid of it. You actually gave a statistic in your opening there that 40% of people, according to the National Cancer Institute, will actually have, over the course of their lifetime, some sort of a diagnosis of cancer. Now, that can be something that's relatively small and benign, a simple skin cancer, but it can also be something that's lethal. So that's a lot of people. That's almost half the population. So that all sounds very devastating, but there's a lot of myths. So first of all, is having the diagnosis a death sentence? Quite the contrary. And in fact, as time has gone on, we've really gotten much better at understanding cancer. And importantly, there used to be a lot of morbidity associated with cancer treatment, and even that is getting better. The survival rates are improving, and the survival rates really vary significantly depending on the type of cancer.
When I was growing up, cancer was a death sentence. I know family friends who, you know, one day you notice they were thinner and thinner, and then they disappeared. 13-year-old girl I used to take the bus with, one day she wasn't there. It was leukemia. So things have improved. But I know in my dad's own experience, he got cancer in his 80s. It was the chemo that was he felt, even though he died of the underlying cancer, that the chemo was worse than the disease. So tell us about improvements in chemo.
Right. So when I was at UCLA doing my general surgery residency, there was one of the surgical oncologists there who said, you know, what we do to treat cancer is terrible. We burn, slash, and poison, meaning we radiate, we operate, and we give chemotherapy. And things have changed a lot. First of all, the ability to deliver radiation has become much more targeted and much more focused. So that has made a huge difference in terms of not only being able to deliver radiation and treat cancers, but deliver it in such a way that it doesn't cause as much morbidity and is more effective at treating the tumors. Also, the chemotherapy agents have become much more sophisticated over time. That's not to say that some of the old school chemotherapy agents that are associated with a lot of morbidity aren't still around. They are, and they are still used. But, you know, the pharmaceutical industry has really focused a huge amount of resource and energy into being more selective in the treatment of cancer. And now there's a lot of drugs that are very specific at targeting cancers. In fact, there's a drug out called Lynparza. What's interesting about this particular drug is it's used in people who have a specific genetic mutation, and they're using that genetic mutation as a target so that the drug can attack that target. Because as a result of understanding the cancers and how they develop better, we're able to develop drugs that are more targeted, and as a result, we'll have less side effects and are much less toxic and really can not only improve survival, but improve the quality of life. And surgery is still used to treat cancers, but in a much more selective way. And, you know, 30 years ago, a woman who had breast cancer would have a total mastectomy. Now women get a lumpectomy. So, you know, there's a lot of things that have been done to enhance not only the survival, but improve the morbidity associated with the treatment of cancers.
Remember once upon a time, there was this dream that one day there'd be a vaccine against cancer. Is that still considered a possibility?
Right. So it's interesting in two regards. So in regards to the human papillomavirus, now kids are vaccinated against the virus starting at age 12. And it's for exactly this reason, to reduce the risk that they would get the virus and develop cervical cancer later in life. So there's not a vaccine against the cancer per se, but there is a vaccine against the infectious agent that caused it. Now, when I was at UCLA, the researchers there were actually focused on developing a vaccine for melanoma. And there was a tremendous amount of work being done in that area. And interestingly enough, there still is work going on in that area today. It has yet to be proven to be effective. Obviously, we don't hear about, oh, I'm getting a vaccine to prevent cancer. But there is a notion that it may be possible to develop a vaccine someday against certain types of cancers. But as of now, there currently is not.
So overall, you sound pretty hopeful.
Well, look, I personally believe that it's always important for anybody who is sick, whether it's with cancer or heart disease or any other illness, to have hope. And I read an article recently where a very good friend of mine for the past 30 years, Dr. Anton Bilchek, the chief of medicine at the St. John's Cancer Institute, and he had a really interesting message of hope that I think it's important to hear. And I quote, "It is imperative that patients who are diagnosed with cancer, even at an advanced stage, do not lose hope. There are many effective novel therapies as well as more effective surgical techniques. A good example is with the use of modern immunotherapy, up to 40% of patients with stage 4 melanoma are curable, and 50% of patients with stage 4 colon cancer metastatic to the liver can be cured with a combination of chemotherapy and surgery." That quote, I think, is a very hopeful quote, and I think people who have cancer need to have hope. Therapies are getting better all the time. Treatments are available that are effective and that can prolong life and give you good quality of life. And I think that's the message of hope that we need to hold on to.
Dr. Gordon Cohen, MD. Dr. Cohen, thank you.
Thanks, Dave.
This is Seattle's Morning News. Miley Katie's in for Carlene this morning. State health officials are going to take the day to look over data and determine what counties, if any, will have to roll back one phase this weekend. Let's get the details from Cairo Radio's Hannah Scott.
Just a couple of weeks ago, Pierce, Cowlitz, and Whitman County were all sent back to phase two. Tomorrow, we'll find out what other counties might join them. With increasing case numbers and increasing hospitalizations in many parts of the state, several counties are at risk.
There are really a dozen or so counties that are on the border. We're exceeding the metrics to move to phase two or stay in phase two. There are even some that are close to phase one.
And State Health Secretary Dr. Umar Shah says one big concern.
We're also now estimating that 60 to 75% of cases in the state of Washington right now are the B117 variant.
And here in King County, Health Officer Dr. Jeff Duchin.
I don't have any reason to think that we will not move back to phase two.
And some have concerns about the rollbacks, including King County Councilmember Reagan Dunn, who tells KTTH's Jason Rance.
Statewide or countywide decisions to roll back are this old line thinking. That isn't what's happening in the real world now. People who are vaccinated can go out. They can go out and be safe. In fact, the CDC just said you can be in public outside without a mask on. The public health leadership, you know, they are doctors, right? They are not economists, and they're making recommendations based on risk assessments related to individual health of people who aren't yet vaccinated. My job is to think more broadly about jobs, the economy.
Some business owners that Cairo 7 TV spoke with echoed that sentiment.
I think it's pretty sad.
I'm afraid that we keep going on the way we're going, we could have just mass protests and civil unrest.
There's a great joke about the light at the end of the tunnel, and you just hope it's on a train. And these days, I feel like it's a lot of trains.
As it stands right now, it looks like Snohomish, King, Lewis, Grant, Franklin, Stevens, Spokane counties are all at risk of going back a phase. While Pierce County could remain in phase two, as well as Cowlitz County, one other county that's already been pushed back to phase two at the local level, Ferry County, where the small town of Republic of just 1,000 people has seen a super spreader event tied to an Eagles Club event that local health officials say led to at least 100 people getting sick and at least one death. Right now, Ferry County has the fifth worst COVID rate in the nation. Meantime, health officials all across the state are pushing to get everyone vaccinated. Over the weekend, Snohomish County was in danger of losing 600 doses that were about to expire. They got the word out late Saturday evening, and yesterday were able to use all of those doses. There's big concern about vaccine hesitancy, both across the nation and here in the state.
And I thought I heard the governor say that he'd be open to letting businesses limit admission, for example, to people who can prove they're vaccinated.
Yeah, he said that this would not be a state decision, though, I believe, or it would be voluntary, something to that degree. And he said we could see more of that here in the next couple of weeks. I know he's doing something with the cruises where people who were vaccinated could get on these small cruises if they were all vaccinated. And then he said he expected to see some more things like that here in the next 2 to 3 weeks that would be partly government kind of programs and then also just some regular, you know, individual businesses. But once, I don't believe that's the case, though, for those that are having really high case rates. I think that if you go back to phase two or phase one or something like that, then you're not going to have that ability. But I'm not 100% because we haven't gotten all the details.
Yeah. So in other words, you've gotten no hints from the governor's office which direction he's prepared to. Because I think what I heard Reagan Dunn say in that clip makes a lot of sense. If you're if you're vaccinated and the vaccines are 95% effective, why should any of these limits apply to you? The rules should be normal for you.
And that's absolutely true. So we'll see. I have not seen that he's going to say something like that tomorrow. It is possible. He's been not really forthcoming about it, kind of hinting here or there. But I think you're absolutely right. If people are vaccinated, they can show that. I think that you would have some pushback, though. There are people who that's that vaccine passport thing that we were talking about. That there
well,
is
well, but
a that, lot
now
of,
wait. I thought this the objection to the vaccine quote passport was if it was a government mandate. But I mean, for example, we allow private businesses to say you can't bring your gun inside, right? And that's the Second Amendment. I mean, that's a constitutional thing, but private property controls in that case. So why shouldn't it be that individual, like a gym, for example, a gym, that's a private business. So if they say we would like to be able to allow people who have been vaccinated, is there any doctor who would say that's somehow irresponsible?
Not that I've heard, absolutely not. You know, the CDC just came out and said, you know, you don't have to wear your masks in these cases. So I don't know. I know what the governor will say is that it depends on the science. So if he has the science that says that's okay, that's fine. He had told me just a couple of weeks ago that this would not be a government mandate and that maybe they will allow, you know, and then a week later he said maybe they'll have more businesses doing that. So I think it's possible. We'll have to wait and see. I have no inclination that that's coming tomorrow.
What do we know about the vaccine acceptance rate now in Washington State? So, because I don't want to be cruel and heartless here, because I guess I'm sort of saying if you don't take the vaccine, then you're taking your chances, and, you know, too bad if you catch it. But, I mean, what about the efforts to get as many people as want it vaccinated?
And I think that that's what you're going to see, that what we were just talking about, some of those programs and being allowed, anything that where the government gets involved, even that cruise, the cruises that the governor announced that he was going to allow with people who are vaccinated, that's what you're going to see is that incentive, right? Mm-hmm. It's an effort to try to get those people who are hesitant, which is growing. I don't have the exact percentages, but I know it's you know, very much along party lines where you see people in certain parts of eastern Washington that don't want to get vaccinated. I can tell you that I've spoken to many people in Snohomish County who do not plan to get vaccinated. Mm-hmm. And many also people of color in various parts of the state who simply still have the issue of not trusting and do not want to get vaccinated. So it's definitely, I think, a larger issue than many health officials expected.
Hmm. Well, I mean, fair enough. That's your right as an American to say I don't want them to put a needle into my arm. But now let me ask you this. Suppose we adopt my idea and businesses are free to say no vaccination, no service. Does that then open them to a charge of discrimination?
Well, anything's possible. So you have to look into the legality of that. I wouldn't think so. If we've got a public health emergency still going on, I think that you could probably do that. There may need to be a proclamation or something from state health department or the governor. I don't know. But I think what you will see is that you'll see black markets for fake vaccine cards or things like that that end up popping up. So you have to be very careful when you get into this area, I think, because once you do that, if you have bogus, you know, vaccine cards and everybody's just out doing everything, then what's the point?
Well, but okay, so let's say you didn't get vaccinated. You present your bogus vaccine card, you get in, and you get sick.
Mm.
Okay, you're sick now. And here's the one piece of legislation I think we should have. If you do that, right, if you fake your way into a place and you get sick as a result, you can't sue anybody.
Right.
That's your responsibility. So, I mean, that's how I take care of that. Just as long as those people can't sue the business because of a claim that, oh, you made me sick.
Sure, but what if you're the asymptomatic person that gets other people sick? And again, you have to remember, you don't know how long that the vaccine is going to protect everyone. You also have these breakthrough cases where people who have been vaccinated completely end up getting it. It's very rare, but there's all of those kind of scenarios, right? So I think you've got to sell everyone on the vaccine somehow.
All right. I have an idea on that, by the way, in this morning's commentary. Thank you, Hannah.
You bet.
It's time for your daily dose of kindness. It's brought to you by Robert W. Baird & Company, Incorporated. A North Carolina teenager used his time during the pandemic to renew his family's tradition of writing letters, and he turned it into a project aimed at helping others. CBS's Elise Preston has his story.
Learning from what my parents have taught me, I am an African-American male that was born into this world to do incredible things.
At just 15 years old, Osir Black is a published author. The North Carolina high school sophomore loves to run track and spend time with his family, a bond that inspired his book, Exploring Raising Black Sons in America.
Do you fear for your safety, Osir?
Of course. No matter how smart I am, no matter what I'm doing in my life, the first thing, like my mom said, the first thing that people see is my skin color.
Osir's book, Love Letters to My Son, is a collection of letters written by nearly a dozen black mothers, including his own.
For you, as a black mom of two boys, why is it important to affirm your children?
Oh, my. The affirmation starts with me. I need to ensure that in spite of what the world tells my children, they are clear in who they are.
Race isn't the book's only focus. It also discusses mental health and financial literacy, topics Osir's late grandmother often addressed in letters she wrote.
They were encouraging. They kept you going.
Osir hopes his book will speak to a diverse audience.
Not just black moms, not just sons, but I really just wanted people to understand the mindset that mothers are teaching their sons.
And maybe inspire families to share words of wisdom in letters of their own. Elise Preston, CBS News, New York.
It's a powerful book.
Yeah.
Do you, I don't know, you don't have children, do you?
I don't. Nope.
I know parents who write regular letters to their children. I have a feeling that that probably has dropped off a lot since people stopped writing actual written letters. You know, it's a little difficult, I guess, to send, encouraging emails instead of a letter. But yeah. I think it's a great idea. And one of the things that that I also noticed about people who have kids is they will have friends write them letters to be opened like years later, right? On their first birthday, somebody writes a letter to be opened when they're five, and then another writes a letter to be opened when they're 16. Of course, they're usually letters of affirmation, and I think it does. I think it is a real morale boost, especially if it's a dark time, to open a letter written by somebody who loves you and hear them give you encouraging thoughts.
I agree. My parents actually did something kind of parallel to that. Have you heard of Storyworth? It's where
no.
it's a company. It's the best Christmas gift I've ever given. I gave it to both my parents a few years back. And so they get email prompts every week for a year. And it could be something like, why did you fall in love with mom? Or what was your neighborhood like growing up? Or what made you decide to go into whatever profession? And then at the end of the year, it's published in a book and you can write it in whatever format you want. So it could be in the form of a letter, but I consider those my parents' advice and story to myself.
I think that's great. Yeah. I didn't find out until my dad died and we went through some of his papers that he had trouble figuring out what he wanted his career to be after the war was over. And we never really had a talk like that. So I think it's a good idea. Good idea for parents to communicate with their kids in that way. Here is G. Scott, who's going to brief me on all the news I missed during the past week. So what's the big story?
Man, the big story is vaccine hesitancy. Yeah, that term, those words have been used all week. It's going to be the word in terms that's going to be used this week. And I'd say, Dave, first of all, I missed you. Glad you're back. I'd say that what you really missed out on, I feel there's a shift maybe in people getting better about talking about it. I'll admit I'm trying to be better about talking about it. And here's what I mean. If someone is nervous about the vaccine or if they have vaccine hesitancy, the worst thing that somebody wants to do is call them an idiot or call them or say that, oh, you don't know what you're talking about. You need to go get the vaccine because it's real, right? The vaccine hesitancy is real. People do have hesitations for why they don't want to get it or there's a pause. Whatever the case might be, you know what happened with the Johnson & Johnson. So I think the biggest thing that you missed is our conversations and how we are talking about vaccine hesitancy in the public and in our communities.
It's people's right not to get vaccinated if they don't want to. I don't see any point in forcing them. But at the same time, I don't see any point in keeping the rest of us penalized because there are some people who of their own. Now, if they haven't got access, that's something different. But if the reason they're not getting vaccinated, even though they have access, is because they don't trust the government, like I say, it's your right not to trust the government. But that doesn't mean my gym should be closed down because of you.
Yeah, we on the same page with this, Brother Dave. Like these rollbacks right here, I call them moving goalposts. And what you're basically doing is, I definitely don't like this. Oh, well, you guys haven't been responsible. Hold up. On one hand, like you just said, Dave, I'm going to be solid and cool and have better understanding for those who have vaccine hesitancy. But at the same time, you're going to punish these gyms. You're going to punish these small business owners that own restaurants. You're going to punish those who are trying to maybe have a wedding or all of the things that people are hurt by these decisions. Sure, it's easy for me to talk about because the phases don't hurt me personally, financially. But that doesn't mean that I don't care about others. Right. And the fact that people are being impacted by these rollbacks, I got to admit, it's kind of frustrating.
Well, let me ask you this.
Yeah.
When you look at the demographics of who's turning down the vaccine, it appears that minorities and rural people are overrepresented.
Yeah.
So I'll challenge my own argument. If that's the case, if you essentially allow private businesses to require the vaccine card as the price of admission, does that not become discriminatory?
Duh. Well, you can definitely make an argument for it, right? And I guess you're right. I guess in some ways it does cross that line with that. And right now we're dealing with a global pandemic that just so many of us, I mean, this is the first time we've ever dealt with something like this. And the reason why I have so much empathy for those that are struggling or maybe have hesitation. I don't want to call you, struggling is a bad word to use, but I think about my uncle who is 65 years old and he refuses to get it. Mm-hmm. Right. And there's absolutely nothing that I can say. Now I care more, you know, I'm talking to him more. Like sometimes if someone tells me, I don't even try to argue with you, but I found myself almost in an argument with my uncle because I care so much about him. And according to him, he's like, if you care so much about me, you leave me alone. So it's like a a catch 22.
And let me ask you this. Were you to visit him, would you, in deference to him, wear your mask? Because even vaccinated people could, you know,
yes,
possibly still be carriers.
Absolutely would wear my mask.
Yeah.
Absolutely. If I did visit him. Yes. Yes. And he's one of those folks, too. You know, he wears the mask where he has to, if you mm-hmm. will. And you know, that's the thing about COVID. COVID's tricky. You might go in some of the same situations and same environments and not contract COVID the entire time. But they just have one day. You just never know. So again, Dave, the point you just brought up when private corporations, organizations start to make the vaccine cards acceptable, like saying like, hey, to come into our place of business, you need to have your vaccine. Oh boy, we are really running into something that I just didn't foresee a few months ago when we were talking about getting these vaccines out.
G. Scott joins Ursula 9 o'clock here on Cairo Radio. Thanks, G.
Thanks, buddy.
While things like COVID, policing, equity, and taxes were the main focus of the legislative session, there was progress on other big issues, too, one of which Hannah Scott has been following for years.
Democratic State Representative Tina Orwall has led the efforts to get our state's massive rape kit backlog tested, working with colleagues on the other side of the aisle, like Gina Mosbrucker, and with several sexual assault survivors. She hasn't stopped there, getting more done every session. And this year was no exception with House Bill 1109, which, among other things, creates the follow-up on these old kits by requiring the state attorney general, in consultation with the Washington Association of Sheriffs and Police Chiefs, to collect status updates on cases that are tied to the backlog.
Really having very transparent data of what happened on the untested kits. Right. We need to know what happened with the investigations and prosecutions, especially on the 600 CODIS hits, which means they, you know, connected to another case in the FBI system. And so that was one component of the bill that we had to work very carefully on throughout the whole session.
Though under this bill that's already been signed by the governor,
you have law enforcement, right, which is very localized. And then you have the attorney general on who's collecting what information, who's bringing the report together. And what we really learned is that some of it's going to be case reviews, and others, like what the attorney general does on the CODIS hits, is actually maybe hitting two or three jurisdictions, right? Some of these cases connect to different parts of the state, and there's that entity that needs to tie, you know, these cases together, because we do have a number of serial offenders out there. And so they both have an important role to play, and we want to capture both when we really report back to the legislature and to the community.
But that's not all this bill does.
Well, there were two other components. One is our Survivor Bill of Rights. And we started that a couple years ago, and it's kind of modeled off the federal level, but we really strengthened it this year. I think we're the only state in the country that has a right of action that a survivor can take in the court if their rights aren't being fulfilled. But we really added important pieces, like, you know, every survivor should have a community advocate every step of the legal process, right? And we also added interpreter services and the right to records, and really just making the process more transparent and more supports for survivors.
It's everything to survivors of sexual assault. because the way things have been.
You know, I've just heard, one, so many survivors feel like they're on trial. Like our whole process really is so non-trauma informed and actually, I think, harms survivors. And so I think everything we can do to actually make that process supportive to help them, you know, they're going to re-experience trauma during the trial. And they need that support person next to them and counseling and services to get through what, you know, was probably one of the most painful experiences in their life. And so I just think these services are long overdue, and just really just want to, you know, King County Sexual Assault Center and some of the agencies worked with us on these to make sure we got it right.
And on top of that.
And then the third component, and I'm really excited because I think we're really doing some incredible things, kind of leading the nation around the trauma-informed training that we're doing for officers. But what we've linked is the commission now has a group of experts that go do case reviews. That allows us to see where the officer's able to use the new skills they learned in training. What things are we finding when we review the charts in the investigation or prosecution that we need to train to that are problematic? And again, you know, it could be, you know, really simple things that are happening that could be very harmful. And again, we don't want survivors to feel like they're being interrogated, or we don't want to use language that might make them feel like they're not believed or supported.
Well, it may not seem like a lot to you. It's everything to survivors of sexual assault.
You know, they're often put in the same rooms that they interrogate, and they use the word alleged. And, you know, all of these things we need to change, right? Because again, it's making that survivor feel like they're on trial. And that's not what's occurring here.
And Hannah, what's the size of the backlog right now?
So remember, it was over 10,000. We're now at about 3,600. All of the backlog kits, those are the ones that are prior to 2015, are due and on track to be finished by July of next year. So just a little over a year. Yeah. And then that high throughput lab is now, they had to kind of actually, that's the faster lab. So you get a much faster turnaround time where it'll take 45 minutes a year from now. When the lab is all set and doing its thing, that they used for the COVID test back at the beginning of the pandemic. And actually, it'll be up and running this year, the lab will. So I'm going to be going down there with her over the summer to get an up close look.
Yeah, I hadn't thought about that. But for every test that is processed, that means bringing a woman into an interrogation room and going over all the evidence again, right?
It does, and hopefully not interrogation room. That's what she was trying to say. They don't. It's not, you know, it's traumatic for them. You have to bring that woman in, and she has to relive that and go through everything. The other, and she's not done yet, by the way. So Representative Orwell has done so many things every year since 2015. Next session in 2022, she's also working on getting the sexual assault nurse examiners. There is not an accurate number. These are the forensic nurses who do a rape kit. And there are not only hospitals that don't have them, there are counties that don't have them at all in any of their hospitals. There are hospitals in Seattle that do not have these nurses available to do a rape kit, which means, as we, Leah Griffin, who I've spoken to many times as a survivor, she showed up to the hospital for a rape kit in Seattle and was told they didn't have a nurse, and they asked her to get into a cab and go somewhere else.
Wow. Even right. Seattle? You don't have
Yes. Yes. And that is still the case. I'm not going to say what hospital, but it is still the case.
Wow. All right. Since I was out in the last week, can you bring me up to date on some of the big issues that the legislature was going to handle? So what's the status of the whole capital gains discussion?
The capital gains tax was passed. It's a 7% on $250,000 or more. Mm-hmm. It takes effect. There was no emergency clause included, but there is language that will keep it from a referendum. It would have to be an initiative to challenge it. Mm-hmm. And there's already one lawsuit that was filed last week. A second one is on the way. And the lawsuit challenges it based on the Commerce Clause because it affects out-of-state capital gains. And then it also is, you know, over the fact that it's an illegal income tax, they say.
Mm-hmm. And so that means what? Enforcement? Well, it's not going to be enforced right away. When is it supposed to kick in?
It doesn't kick in. I believe collections would start in 2022 with the finances available by 2023.
Gotcha. On police reform, anything changed there?
I can't remember the last time we spoke about it. So a lot was done. Really, all the big ticket items. You have independent investigations were done. We've got the next session. You will see a bill for independent prosecutions when it comes to deadly use of force cases involving police. You also have the right to the duty to intervene was passed. The acceptable uses of force. All of those bills that really had a lot to do with what happened with George Floyd. They were all born, many of them, out of what happened with
and
George Floyd.
Did that
Floyd.
Get bipartisan support?
Some, not all. There was many Republicans who pushed back about the use of force. Some on the duty to intervene. The one that I think the decertification bill also passed. That's the one that you take away a cop's license. Mm-hmm. That one had a lot of pushback. It was the duty to intervene where you saw Fraternal Order of Police and that a couple of other groups who came out and did support that one. Because nobody's going to sit there and say everything that those officers did standing next to Officer Chauvin in the George Floyd case was okay. So that's kind of what the duty to intervene is. You don't stand around. You have to get involved.
Right. Well, that makes a lot of sense.
Sure.
Hannah Scott. Thank you, Hannah.
You bet.
Thanks for listening to Seattle's Morning News, the podcast. I'm Dave Ross.
And I'm Colleen O'Brien. You can find our podcast weekday mornings right at 9:30.
And if you subscribe, you'll never miss the Daily Dose of Kindness.